Welcome to Conversations for Financial Professionals, a podcast to help shape the next generation of financial advice. I'm your host, Dominique Henderson, and today's conversation is with Rob Burtman. Rob Burtman is a senior consultant for the Student Loan Planner, and he helps borrowers rid themselves of student loan debt. I am so excited for this conversation today because we talk about the student loans crisis and how bad is it. Rob is going to give us some solutions. He's obviously got the stats because he and his colleagues over at Student Loan Planner have counseled over 4,500 people in student loans and over $1.2 billion of loans counseled. So he knows his stuff. We talk about solutions. We talk about fixing the mess and how this can be avoided in the future when we start to think about the long-term ramifications of the student loan crisis. I want you to leave this podcast knowing and feeling empowered, not only as a consumer of financial services about the fact that there's help out there for you, but as a provider of financial services to know that you can find experts in this area that will enhance the client relationship and take it to the next level. So enjoy the conversation with Rob Burtman. Welcome to another episode of the Conversations for Financial Professionals podcast, where we are shaping the next generation of financial advice. And today we have Rob Burtman. Rob, you hold both the coveted CFA and CFP designations and are a University of Michigan alum. Go Wolverines.
Go Blue.
Fab Five from way back in the day.
That was awesome.
Dates me. Yeah.
I remember too.
Oh my gosh. But you are a senior consultant for Student Loan Planner, where you help borrowers rid themselves of student loan debt. And I guess when you're not bulldozing student loans, you are known as the family budget expert, which is your brand to help parents find the extra money in their budget to reach their financial goals, even if the cost of raising kids is breaking the bank and stressing their relationship. Having put two kids through college at this point for myself, and working on the last one, I really wish I would have met you about 6 years ago. Welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Dominique. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah, man, this is great. You and I know a shared circle of individuals, Lauren Williams and Travis and Megan. There's just like so many really, really cool people that you're working with over there. And I really am happy and excited that you're here today talking to us about student loans and what I was, you know, maybe but the future of the student loan crisis, right? Because I do see it that way. But before we dig into that, tell me, how's 2021 been going for you? We all had a 2020 to remember. How has the new year been treating you so far?
Yeah, it's been okay so far. I mean, personally, you know, fortunately we're doing okay. We're hanging in there, you know, with three younger kids, it's always an adventure, but fortunately, I have a good relationship with my wife and my kids, so that's about all we can ask for these days.
No, you're right. It sounds like an attitude of gratitude, which is what you decided to kind of posture yourself as being. So I'm very happy to hear that.
Yeah, thanks.
Let's kind of dive into this. I think there's probably three areas that I think would really benefit not only consumers of financial services, but also providers of financial services when we're talking about this subject of student loans, because this is a fairly large, gargantuan topic. But if I'm thinking about it from the standpoint of how bad is it and what are some solutions and then how do we kind of fix this mess type of deal is kind of the way that I think people would get the most benefit about doing this. So you've been with Student Loan Planner for a few years now. And I just want to get your macro take as a person boots on the ground. When I call this a crisis, am I overstating this or am I spot on?
No, I think you're spot on. I mean, a lot of people are hurting with student debt. I mean, there's $1.5 trillion out there, which is, you know, a million or 1.5 million million is basically another way to put a trillion. So, you know, in other words, I mean, that's a lot of money. And more importantly, it affects about 45 million people. And I can tell you when I started, so I have a background in investment management and securities analysis and financial planning. And I just thought student loans, you know, you just kind of approach it. If you can, you just do it the traditional way, you know, line it up, cut your budget, and pay it back as fast as you possibly can. What I learned, however, is although we are in a crisis, that actually the federal student loan repayment guidelines and strategies are actually pretty accommodating for people. And it doesn't have to be the burden that people think it is. And that's something that I had absolutely no idea when I started at Student Loan Planner 3 years ago. And, you know, 3 years later, 900 consults just personally later and advising on over, you know, $200 million of student debt. I know that there is now a way, and I'm confident that I can help people, that there is a way to, instead of having to build your life and career around student debt, that there's a way to build the student debt and loan repayment strategy around the career and life that people want to live. And that's been something that when we're talking with people individually or when we get questions from people, that it's such a burden for people and it affects their lives so deeply that when they realize that and when they can see that, it actually, I mean, you can just see the weight fall off, you know, their shoulders drop, the weight falls off of their back, yeah. and they can now operate and feel good about it. But it is a big problem for sure.
Yeah, I've often compared this, and it sounds like I've been right to do this. I've compared the student loan crisis to the housing crisis, except for the fact that at least with the housing crisis, you had a mortgage. You could actually go sell the property. Whereas I don't know that you can mortgage your brain. Like, you know, there's no collateral. Like this is one of those loans where the holder of the paper, which is maybe the reason why this thing has gotten securitized so many times and yada, yada, yada. The holder of the paper is really, really like, you know, kind of SOL. There's really nothing else you can do. But I guess what I'm trying to say is the implications for what this may mean for taxpayers 10 or 20 years down the road, because in a lot of instances, it's not the private sector that backs these loans, if I'm not mistaken, it's the federal government, which means taxpayers.
Exactly.
So what is your assessment of what this looks like at the current trajectory 10 or 20 years from now for taxpayers?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, the OMB, you know, the Office of Management and Budget, they only project 10 years down the road. Mm-hmm. And a lot of these programs, you know, there's different things you can do, like income-driven repayment plans, where at the end of 20 or 25 years of payments based upon income, whatever loans are remaining get forgiven. And these programs are so new that they're not even 10 years out from people mm-hmm. reaching that. So we don't really know what it's going to look like. But I think what happened is, you know, when the federal government started getting involved in student loans, it kind of gave universities a free pass to raise their tuition. And what you're seeing now is the cost of education skyrocketing. I mean, it was, you know, big back in the day when you and I were in school in like the 90s and early 2000s. But I mean, the growth of tuition has just been insane, especially for graduate level professions like veterinary school, chiropractic school, you know, dentistry school. I mean, all of these post-secondary or I guess graduate level professions, the cost of tuition is astronomical. And so, go ahead.
No. Go ahead and finish that. I was gonna. And you're. It's a perfect segue into what I was gonna ask, which was, what do you think is the biggest contributing factor? You know, I was reading not too long ago some writings that Thomas Sowell did, and he was basically talking about this education inflation factor. And I just look at my own stuff. You know, so I graduated in '98 with, you know, I had all scholarships, but I think the cost of me going to school was something less than 10 grand a year. Mm-hmm. And my son goes to the same school, but, you know, Texas has flat tuition. But the point is it's like 26 grand. And I'm like, 250% over less than 20 years. I mean, like, that does not make sense. That's not normal inflation if you're just doing the math of it. And so I guess my point is, and maybe you've answered this, has it really been consumer demand for education that has pushed the cost of education up? Or has it really been, you know, I guess the backstop of student loans being paid for essentially or guaranteed by the government that has allowed these institutions to just jack up the education prices?
It's both, really. I mean, college education is important for those that can do it. But I mean, if you think about the top, you know, income earners in the country, and now the top income earners are concerned about how they're going to pay for their kids' college. So to me, this is all really unsustainable because at some point, you know, people, you know, I think that the top schools like the Ivy League schools and stuff like that, they're always going to be able to increase their tuition because there's a demand for people that can afford it or for people that get scholarships to go to those top level schools. But what's happened is, especially in, let's say, pharmacy school or chiropractic school, is that there are schools opening up all over the place. And even though there's more seats to fill, because the demand has been so great, they've been able to increase their tuition at the same time. So you have more seats, rising tuition, college becoming less affordable. So there's something's got to give at some point. I just don't know exactly what that would be.
My deal is just anecdotally, man, I don't know. And this gets into some of the solutions. I'm wondering how much COVID has helped decelerate this acceleration, if you will, because if you increase the amount of seats, increase the amount of tuition, obviously your top line revenue, just from a mathematical standpoint, increases. It's like, where is this money going? Because there are universities right now, and I know this, my daughter goes to Sam Houston, like these classes are being done hybrid or almost all virtual, and the buildings are empty. So where's the money going? Like, is it going to pay professors? Like, I'm just curious. Like, do you have any thoughts on that?
I think that schools are building up amenities to attract students. So it's becoming competition of going to the campuses and seeing who's got the best campus, the newest buildings, the best dorm rooms, the best off-campus housing, which is some of the decision-making. And then also combined with the fact that, there are a lot of major colleges and universities that are really, really building up their endowments. And you have some of the top schools with multi-billion dollar endowments. And you would think that in the COVID crisis that these endowments would be used to subsidize tuition or to help, help people out in these tough times, but they haven't done that. In fact, tuition has stayed the same or gone up even in this year. Wow. So I don't really know the answer to that. My guess is that it's just going, I think the cost of operating these schools and universities are very, very high, but there's also a lot of profit in there. But I think some people are going to get more wise to it. I mean, so for undergraduate, we have to look at undergraduate degrees different than graduate level degrees because.
And why is that? Okay, go ahead.
Well, just getting a college degree is, important in terms of the expected earnings over someone's career. Once you get out of the top 25, top 50 schools, it doesn't matter that much as much of in terms of employment, where that degree comes from.
And just to clarify, you're just saying school number 25 and school number 26, there's a marginal difference, if any, with your lifetime earnings with going to that 25th or 26th school.
Yeah. I mean, obviously you want to go to a school that has great, faculty and you get a great education. That's a number one, but the employment opportunities for people after getting a college degree, it's not what it used to be, right? It used to be that if you had a college degree, you get certain jobs. And before COVID hit, the economy, some employers, because of unemployment was so low, some employers were saying, you don't need a college degree, we need people to work. So just come and work. But for graduate level degrees, it can really, really boost the income up even more. For example, the difference between a college graduate and a physician, or like a college graduate and a dentist, those are some really, really big differences. So paying a lot of money to go to a graduate school like dentistry school or to medical school can actually really, really dramatically ramp up the income.
All right. Now, let me ask you this. Are you seeing the proportion of debt that you're counseling on is attributed mostly to the graduate studies versus the undergrad, if you had to divide it up in a pie?
Yeah. And part of that is because there are caps on how much people can borrow in the federal program for undergrad, but for graduate level programs, there's essentially no cap. Whereas someone might only be able to borrow, let's just call it $100,000 for undergrad, they can borrow $400,000 for dentist school, or $200,000 for medical school. And so most of the there's over 3 million people with six figures of student debt out there.
And okay, pause right quick. That's crazy. Because I was just thinking, and so this is not totally accurate, but okay, let me add 4 years. So you can have let's call it a 670 FICO score and barely qualify for a mortgage, but you can be a 22-year-old grad student and qualify for $200,000 or $400,000 of money to go to school. Is this correct?
Pretty much. I mean, there are limitations around it. I mean, for people that can't borrow through the federal program, they're, getting private debt to finish the education is a little bit different. But, then we get into these large numbers. And when you get into large numbers, kind of like, like if someone's buying a car, and let's just say they want to, they're going to buy a car for $30,000. Okay, that's a lot of money. Now, if someone wants to, you know, get all the bells and whistles and have the, you know, and it raises the price of buying the car to $35,000, people don't really blink at that because they're already spending $30,000. So what's another $5,000?
Yeah.
Well, it's another $5,000. So when people are so invested in their education, and then they see, when they look at the projections of what school is going to cost, they say, oh, wait, but they're going to increase tuition every year. And oh, wait, the loans I took out, they're going to be accruing interest, some of them along the way as I go. And when I graduate, I'm going to owe a lot more and have to take out a lot more. At that, at some point, you have to say, I just got to finish this thing because I'm already $100,000 in debt. Why not go $300,000 in debt or whatever? And then the law, what's the difference between $100,000 and $200,000? When you're in that mode, psychologically, yeah, it doesn't seem like a lot. Yeah. But when you're paying it back, it's a lot.
I think you bring out one aspect of this that I never thought about was the psychological aspect, really the psychological trap of this. When you started something, the human nature is, since we're goal-striving beings, is to finish it no matter what the cost, nominally on paper, black and white, I'm signing my life away. And then I think what I've heard too is, you know, especially I've heard this with lawyers where it's like, well, I'm going to be making X when I get out too. So, you know, I'll be able to repay this, but then maybe kind of walk us through, well, yeah, you're making X gross, but you know, you still got a, you got health insurance, you got taxes, you got, you know, hopefully you're putting well, some money in your 401k, and then you're getting a percentage of every dollar that you actually make.
Yeah. I mean, you know, unless people have worked before college or in college, it's hard to know what the paycheck's actually going to look like. Because unless someone has paid for their living expenses, you don't really know until you actually start doing it. And once that happens, all of a sudden making $100,000, it's only taking home $5,000 a month. And that's a lot different. And you make these choices based upon 100K, but you're not taking that home. Yeah. But the good news is with student debt is that, is these income-driven repayment options. So, you know, if we think of student loans, they can actually be treated more like a tax rather than a debt. And what I mean by that is, you know, the best repayment programs right now, you can pay based upon 10% of your income. So if someone's going to increase their income substantially by finishing school or finishing a graduate level degree, you know, they have their state taxes and federal taxes, unless you live in Texas and you don't have state taxes, and sometimes local taxes. And then the student loan payment, if you think of it like a tax, if it's going to increase someone's income and help them do something that they really want to do, it could make sense to take out the debt in order to do that.
Mm-hmm. And when you say thinking of it as a tax, just a portion, you know, because I'm not W-2 anymore, being self-employed, but you know, the point is, you know, there's a portion of whatever I make that I already know is not going to me, right? I got money that goes over to a tax account because I know that goes to Uncle Sam, mm-hmm, or whatever. And maybe almost kind of think about that. I don't know if you even advise that when you're counseling with student loans, is like you almost create an account to pay back your student loans. So like when your money comes in, you don't even see it. Like that's almost like a tax that you're paying. So just like your 401k or your medical benefits, is that maybe what you're referring to or something different?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the payment that goes out on a monthly basis to the loan servicer, that is pretty much set in stone for 12 months. You know, so you certify your income using a tax return, mm-hmm, your prior year tax return, you know, usually, and then your payments are based upon 10% of that income. Now they take adjusted gross income. So it's after, you know, pre-tax retirement and any other type of pre-tax deductions. Mm-hmm. And then there's also like another deduction on the back end of between 20 and 30,000, depending on family size. So if you look at it that way, it may only end up being like another 7% tax in the form of a student loan payment. You know, the most important thing with for any financial success, and again, I always thought like you got to optimize your investments if you want to make money. And it's true if you want to grow your money, but the most important skill, and this is why I started Family Budget Expert, is having money left over at the end of the month. Mm-hmm. And whether it's going to debt repayment, whether it's going to retirement, whether it's building an emergency fund, anything that is a net worth building activity. And people forget that paying down debt is a net worth building activity. You're taking a negative number and moving it up to zero.
Yep.
And the interest rate on that debt, if someone is going the traditional route, is kind of like a guaranteed tax-free rate of return on investment. So, but people that struggle, they can't figure out how to get the money left over at the end of the month to even make the student loan payments or even, you know, pay their credit card bills off and stuff like that. And that's a really big problem. But I think what student debt has done, one of the silver linings of it is that, you know, if you take a look at the stats, millennials are actually better budgeters than the baby boomers. You know, there are more millennials who often get a bad rap for being financially irresponsible, but the stats show that they're not. And I know you and I are like right on the cusp. We're kind of like millennial Gen Xers.
Yeah.
And so, you know, people are taking this seriously and they need to, because it's a lot of debt. So, but at the end of the day, having that money left over and figuring that out is going to be the number one skill set that's going to allow getting out of debt of any kind and building wealth of any kind.
No, and I think this kind of points to some of the solutions and or fixing the mess, because I think one component that I hear you saying, and you didn't actually name it, but it's there, it's financial literacy, right? It's knowing how your money works and cash flow being a big component of it. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head with, you know, a lot of people have more month than money. But that's sometimes not because of the product of how much they actually make. It's just because they don't really know where their money's going. They don't, you know, they're spending it on whatever and they don't have some type of tracking, or they're not working with somebody to hold them accountable to helping them keep a budget. So let's kind of talk about that a little bit, because I mentioned earlier about, you know, having this 670 FICO score and wanting to buy a house. So, you know, I get, you know, buying a home is going to be, you know, some of the things that people want to do to build wealth, but there's probably an order that they need to be in, especially if they have a large amounts of student loan, and we won't get into the weeds of that. But what I do want to ask you are your thoughts, Rob, on financial professionals' approach to this, right? So you have a client come to you and they've got all this stuff going on and they've got student loans. I think this has been a particularly sensitive subject area for a lot of reasons. I think the main reason, if I was to guess, is that although people may be doing well nominally, making six figures, doing all this kind of stuff, when they have six figures of student loan debt, to your point earlier, it's just a weight. They kind of can't even see, you know, the forest for the trees, because it's just right in front of them all the time. And so I wonder if you have any techniques for, you know, how you approach that as a financial professional. You know, do you just say always outsource to like a student loan planner, or is there some things that you can be doing as a financial professional to help ease that burden of people, even when you're sitting with them in that first meeting?
Yeah. So on the student loan side, at the end of the day, when people feel like they have a plan, a clear plan, they know their options, they know how to implement it, they know the path forward, that clarity, it on its own is a relief without the financial relief of knowing that they're going about it the optimal way.
Attention career changers and aspiring financial professionals. If you're serious about entering the financial services industry but confused about what path is right for you, then you might be a perfect candidate for the Jumpstart Accelerator Group. I've created a pathway to reduce the amount of friction and frustration as you map out your journey to become a financial professional. In the Jumpstart Accelerator Group, you'll get access to a private Facebook community with some groundbreaking trainings and great discussion with your peers, one-on-one mentorship from a hand-picked Jumpstart ambassador to help you with your journey, and a special invitation to join my 12-week program called How to Find Your Place in the Financial Services Industry. I'm serious about fulfilling my mission of making sure that everyone has access to good financial advice. And that's why I'm taking my 20 plus years in the financial services industry and sharing it with you, the next generation financial professional. The Jumpstart Accelerator Group launches March 2021, and I want you to be part of it. To learn more, just send me a quick email with Jumpstart Accelerator in the subject line to hello@jumpstartcoachinglab.com, or click the programs and services link at jumpstartcoachinglab.com. Now, let's get back to our conversation.
So when people have a bunch of student debt, it's not necessarily about paying it back as much as it is having the clarity of how to pay it back. And then on the budget side and just general financial planning side, I always think that, you know, we need the financial foundations. If we look at, you know, Maslow's hierarchy, right, which is the base is like safety and security and, you know, basic needs. To me, you know, most people's food and shelter. In the financial world, it's emergency fund and zero credit card debt. And then for people with student debt, you add in the student loan plan along that. Because if people have a cash if they put all their money towards building up a little bit of a cash cushion, if they had zero credit card debt, because to me, credit card debt is like the gateway drug into all sorts of financial ruin. And any type of credit, some people are like, oh, it's okay to just leave a little bit of a balance. Well, that's like the toe over the line into that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so people need to reset their thermostats of what they're comfortable with financially. And some people who are comfortable with, you know, having $1,000 in the bank and a little bit of credit card balance, they need to really like psychologically up what they're comfortable with. You know, because for example, let's just say someone's comfortable having $1,000 in the bank. Well, when they have $3,000 in the bank, they feel like they can go crazy and just, you know, hey, I got some extra money, I can spend it. But when their balances get into that zero, that puts a lot of stress on them. Mm-hmm. But if they said, I'm not comfortable with $1,000 anymore, I'm only comfortable if I have $5,000 in the bank, then they'll get that fire burning to be more conscious of their spending until they get up to the $5,000. But in any case, if people have those three things, it's amazing the relief that people get when they have a student loan plan, when they have no credit card payments other than, you know, paying it off on a monthly basis, and when they have a cash cushion in case something happens. When those three check boxes are marked, I mean, they feel like they can do anything. And
no, I'm glad you said that, because I think, you know, 2020 is a marker for, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, we'll look back. I've made up several jests about this and that. You know, me and my wife always go like, so what year was that? Like, we're not going to have that problem with 2020. But, you know, so 2020 handed us the global pandemic. And I think to your point, you know, some of the advice that I was giving my clients was like, hey, you know, if you want to double your emergency fund in a pandemic year, I'm not mad at you. Like, we can sacrifice the 6 or 7%. I'm pretty sure we can make that up later in the market. But if you feel better by just upping that up and tightening the belt strings, because we don't know what's going to happen, and this is like last March or April, then that's cool. And I think you give a lot of solid advice there, because one thing that came to mind when you said $1,000 just made me think of Dave Ramsey, where it's like that, you know, the baby emergency fund. But I mean, that could be gone so quickly, you know, you might have to up that barrier. So what are some of the things that you think that people should be thinking about in regards to, I guess, the psychology about that? I love the way you put that with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, but just kind of, you know, parried it to the whole financial thing. Is there anything else that you would layer on top of that, those three things?
Let me think about that. Yeah, I would say in terms of the student loans that, you know, it's okay to table them, even if it is a stress point. If someone has massive credit card debt, or they don't have a lot of money in the bank, and their job could be at risk of going away, or, you know, losing some income, then it's okay to pause the student loan payments and come back to it. You know, I think at some point we have to pair things back. You know, I would say like another thing along with that is just the mindset. There are people that obviously out there that can truly not afford certain things in life and not afford their rent or not afford their heating bill. And that's a really, really terrible situation. But a lot of people use those words, I can't afford it, when actually they can't afford it. And instead of using the word afford, I like to substitute afford with choice, assuming that someone's in a situation where they do have a choice. And so, you know, because sometimes when we say afford, it puts us in a negative mindset that we are trapped and that we cannot do something that we want to do. But if it's like, well, I could go out to eat and spend $15 on lunch, or I could take that money and put it into retirement. It's about having that choice instead of saying, oh, I can't afford to put money in my retirement, but because we're making decisions every day that we could actually choose to make a different choice. So especially with kids, you know, you and I have kids, and I'm very, you know, we're in a position where obviously we can make choices. And so I'm very careful about using the word afford with them. And I think just psychologically, when people have student debt, when they have credit card debt, when they have bank, if they're making it, when they have low bank account balances, if you're really making above the poverty level and you can make ends meet, then stop using the word afford and start using the word choice.
No, I love that. I think this is the reason why, and I always get back to this theme. This is the reason why I think more often than not, people need the accountability, the professionalism that is brought by a financial professional. And it's just because it may not be because you're not a good investor. I mean, you might actually do well in the market, but as we've been having this conversation for the last 30 minutes, we've not even talked about investments, but all the stuff we've talked about are so crucial before you even get to the investment, because otherwise you may end up, you know, pulling out your 401k as good as it's doing in a year like last year in 2020 to help subsidize your living expenses because you haven't done things in the right order. So what I would really love for you to opine on is this notion about having a financial professional, because you said a couple of things that were so juicy. So the first thing about choice, right? So I love the substitution of choice for afford, because I think as financial professionals, what we are is stewards to help people take their limited time and money and spread that across unlimited choices. So I think that's a beautiful way that you've put that. In regards to choice, let's talk about a specific strategy. And I know you guys have some information on Student Loan Planner that we'll definitely link up in the show notes. We got this whole thing with the zero interest moratorium. And so I've had clients ask me about that and strategize around where I should refinance, but I'm in zero interest and blah, blah, blah. I think this points to, let's talk to a professional, but I, since you are a professional, your boots on the ground, I want to get your opinion on maybe some strategies there or what the best next step would be for someone that has student loans, but we got the zero interest moratorium right now. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah. Well, it's been really great for people to have a relief from their student loan payments and zero, not only zero payments, but zero interest, like you said. And this goes back to, you got to understand what the long-term strategy is best for you. So if someone owes more in student debt than what they earn, so let's just say someone, you know, has 100,000 of debt and they're making 80,000. Refinancing and paying it off might not be the ideal way to go, believe it or not, given that there's income-driven repayment plans with, you know, loan forgiveness at the end. Or if someone is working for a nonprofit employer or, you know, a government employer, they could be eligible for public service loan forgiveness. Once someone refinances, those options are gone, and they have to pay back the debt like they would engage with traditionally with debt. So, but for those people who their long-term strategy is to pay off the debt aggressively and get out of student debt and pay it off all the way, because we're in COVID times and, you know, we're at the height of it, you know, it seems like we're always hitting a new height of it. And we don't know what's going to happen with local municipalities and states are going to choose to do in terms of shutting down. We know there's probably a mask mandate coming, but that doesn't, you know, that could actually help open businesses back up. But with that uncertainty, kind of to your great point earlier, is that, hey, people should be taking this opportunity of zero payments to build up their cash, you know, their cash on hand. And so the 0%, it's going to be 0% until it's not. So if someone builds up a bunch of cash in their bank account, and then at the end, when the 0% expires, they'd actually be better off building up that cash. And then right before the zero expires, then throw a huge lump sum at the debt rather than paying it off. Cause that way you're hoarding cash. If they extend the 0%, you know, right now,
longer it's to hoard cash. Yeah. You're right.
Yeah. If Congress, now that we have a, you know, a Democratic Congress and president-elect and vice president-elect, they could extend it through September. Now we think it's likely it's going to be extended through April, May. So, in any case, it's okay to hoard cash and with zero payments and then throw a giant lump sum at it. Now, for people who are in solid financial positions and they have their emergency fund, they're comfortable with their cash amount, it's okay if they know their long-term strategy is to pay back the debt in full to go ahead and refinance now. And you can go to studentloanplanner.com/refi, and we have some of the best cashback bonuses out there. And then anyone with private debt, you know, rates are at all-time historic lows or near that. So anyone with already private student loans should go to that website and explore if they can get an even lower rate. Because the game, when you know you're going to pay off your debt all the way, is get the lowest interest rate possible and pay it off as quickly as possible.
No, I agree. I highly endorse you guys. Whenever I have something out of my purview, I send my clients to you guys, because I know the type of work that you do over there. I know the caliber of professionalism that you and Travis and Lauren and Megan and all of those guys operate with. So highly recommend that, because I think one of the things that I would like to say as a financial professional that's been doing this is my 20th year in the industry, is I think too often we try to, as financial professionals, whether we're entrepreneurs or working for a firm, we try to do too many things in-house. And there's not enough of collaboration and outsourcing to specialists. I don't do student loans well. Like, there's a whole world of that stuff that I'm supposed to know if I'm a specialist, but I'm not. So why not send them to somebody that knows what they're doing so that my client gets the best care? And I think there's been this notion, I'll just say this, you know, parenthetically, I think there's been this notion that if you send your client away to somebody, then that client will want to stay with that person. And what I would always say is the pushback is like, you must not be doing a great enough job if you send your client away and they stay with someone. So maybe that I help any financial professional that's thinking about this a different way. Maybe you need to first start with your service model before you start thinking that everybody's trying to take your clients. That might be something to think about.
Well, but to your point, I mean, 3 years ago, before I started working with Student Loan Planner, I would have given people horrible student advice because I didn't know about it. I mean, it's almost like you have to do it every day, all day to understand the nuances and how to, you know, and the rules of engagement, because it's not like any other kind of debt. You know, there's not compound interest. You have income-driven repayment. You have loan forgiveness options. You have, you know, if you live in a community property state like Texas, there's ways to take advantage of the community property laws with splitting income. And I mean, it's super complicated to understand everything, but giving the advice once we know all those details, it is... you know, it becomes easier. So, you know, it is a different beast. And I think we work with financial advisors. We partner with financial advisors all the time, as you know, and we welcome the financial advisors to be on the call because the end client who has a student debt has to be on the call. That's a must. Yeah. But the advisor is more than welcome. And in fact, it's encouraged for them to be on there because they need to understand what's going on, the rules of engagement on how it works with a specific client, and they can give more commentary and color so that we can give even better advice. So it actually makes the advisors look really, really good.
I'm glad you said that, and it made me think about something. So if you're a newer advisor or you're just thinking about this a little differently, let me give you a little wisdom, hopefully, is that if you look at Student Loan Planner and the professionals there as an extension of your team, this is part of the service model you offer for clients that are experiencing difficulty with a strategy to pay back their student loans. And you look at Travis and the team and Rob over there as an extension of what you do for your clients, and you attend those calls. It just reinforces the value proposition to the client. I'm 100% sure on this. Try it and you'll be surprised.
Yeah, I appreciate that.
Now, let me do this as we're bringing this thing in for a landing, Rob, and I really, really appreciate your time today. This is a podcast to empower tomorrow's financial professional with tools to serve their clients at an ideal or their ideal clients at the next level. And I think what we've been talking about, especially in the last 30 seconds or so, has really, really underscored that. But in that context, what word or words of wisdom would you leave with that next generation financial professional?
Yeah, I would say that, you know, there's a ton of financial advisors out there and financial planners out there. And the broader public doesn't necessarily know the difference. You know, we're kind of like a commodity where it's, oh, I have a financial advisor. Well, you really have to show your value to people, and the service you have to focus on the service and serving your client probably more than ever, especially with investments being, you know, with robo advisors. The investment piece is more commoditized than ever. Now, for those who are like specialists in investment management and can earn an excess return or proven to do that, that's fine. But advisors really have to set themselves apart by being value add. And I think it is really important to highlight the fact that, you know, if you are a fiduciary, saying that and telling people what that means, that you have their best interests at heart. You're not trying to do this to, you know, to make money. You're doing this to make money, but you're not doing this. The advice that you give is in their best interest, not in your best interest.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to highlight. And also I think, like you hit on, it was a great point, the accountability. You know, a financial planner and financial advisor not only helps implement the plan, but they're also like the coach and the cheerleader and accountability partner. One other thing I would say is that a lot of times as financial professionals, I was definitely this, is we get focused in optimization. What's the optimal path from a numbers perspective? But understand that most clients don't operate optimally. You know, maybe if they're a successful business owner, they might be a financially optimal person. The goal of a financial planner and financial advisor is to give the advice, give good, solid, conflict-free advice that the client's actually going to implement. Mm. So you can get rid of some of the optimization if it's not as optimal, but it's going to be good for them. if they'll do it. So the idea is to get them to do it. We don't want to create financial plans that, you know, are going to stick in a drawer or stay on their hard drive somewhere and never be accessed. We want a living, breathing plan that you can hold them accountable to, that's going to get them in the right place and that resonates with them. So forget optimization, get a solid plan that they're actually going to implement. Implementation is more important.
No, I love that. Implementation over optimization. I love that. I think that's a soundbite that I'll have to retweet once we air this episode. Great stuff, Rob. I really love your approach. I really love your dedication to what you guys are doing over there. Again, if people are listening, have student loans, what is the best resource to point them to in order to get in contact with you guys?
Yeah. So if someone is looking to get a plan, you know, if you're an advisor out there and you have someone with six-figure student debt, if you go to studentloanplanner.com/help, that'll give all the information on the consult process and how to go through that. The price will be based upon, you know, how much student debt they have, give you all the resources you need. Studentloanplanner.com in general is a great resource for anything. You know, if you're just kind of wanting to get your feet wet and understand a little bit more about repayment and you have a client who is in a particular profession, we have tons and tons of blog posts specific to certain professions, whether it's veterinarians, physician assistant, you know, dentists, you know, psychologists, whatever. If you go to our website and look at our blog posts, there will be some great resources for you to read up on so you can be informed when you're talking with your client about student debt. So, I would say studentloanplanner.com is the best way to go. And Dominique, like you said, you know, don't feel like you have to have all the answers for your clients. You definitely want to be informed, but you know, it's kind of like hiring an estate planner or an accountant. You know, student loans are a separate animal and there's certain complexities there that might require someone who does this every day, all day. You know, we've done, I think, 4,500 individual one-on-one consults as a team, and we've advised on over $1.2 billion of student debt. Wow. So we have experience and we'll be able to see the things that maybe you're not sure about, and it'll make you look good for your clients to bring in a professional like you would, like an estate planner or an accountant. And Dominic, let me just say that I think what you're doing is fantastic. You're trying to help raise the level of the profession. And I think we need more people like you out there helping people do a good job for clients. At the end of the day, we want everyone to be successful financially and we want to get the tools in people's hands. And that is helping, you know, it starts by helping the people who are giving the advice to do a better job. So I think that's awesome that you're doing this.
No, I really appreciate that, man. It's a labor of love. And and one of the things that I know for my own spot is that, you know, based on your success, and I think I heard Tyler Perry say this, is that once you get to a certain level of success and or comfort, your job is to hold the door open for others. So I try to live by that as much as I can, but I really appreciate your time. Really, really appreciate your time. And thank you for being on, man, with us. Appreciate it.
Yeah, Dominique, thanks so much.
Hey there, I really hope you enjoyed this conversation. Before we go, just a few things. The best way to retain what you just learned is to do more than just listen. First, you need to write down your most important takeaway, and then you need to give yourself a deadline to apply it. For bonus points, you might also let someone hold you accountable to that deadline. Also, remember, the only way more people will know about this podcast is if you share it. You can do that by sharing a link to this episode on your social media or by leaving a review on iTunes so that it reaches a wider audience. I'd appreciate it if you took the time to do either or both. And finally, if you'd like to join my free community to learn more about how you can become a next generation financial professional, please text me at 214-544-9226. I love to hear from you and point you in the right direction. Bye for now, until our next conversation. Mm-hmm.